live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by a panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Republican Dan Proft, Democrat Mark Casello, and Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Radio Hall of Fame in Chicago, where our phone lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address is btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. We are going to be talking about presidential politics a little bit later on in the broadcast. But again, our first hour tonight, we're going to be talking about probably one of the hottest subjects that is being talked about in the last week, and that is the tragic shooting of Trayvon Martin, the 17-year-old young black man who was shot in Sanford, Florida, by George Zimmerman. It has thrust that story onto the front pages of every newspaper in the United States, virtually every talk show. Cable television is all over it, and it's one of those stories that you really cannot avoid because it once again brings up the subject of whether or not there should be a discussion of race. Is this story about race? And given some of the players that have already jumped to the fore and wanted to speak on this issue, has it elevated the entire discussion? And should the discussion be elevated? I think the discussion should be elevated for a variety of reasons. But, of course, in this case, there's some significant facts that we don't know yet, and I think everyone should acknowledge that. But the President of the United States himself elevated the subject by commenting on it. Mark Casello is our card-carrying liberal tonight. Mark, tell us about your impression of how important this story is. And how can this be a learning moment for the country?
Sure. I think one thing it's exposed to the larger public is that there are still are issues with race in the country. Now, is this particular incident a racial incident will be a question many people will ask. But I think what you see here is a chance to have a conversation about the topic of race and the inequity that exists in the system regarding the incarceration and shooting of black males across the country, many times by law enforcement, that oftentimes goes ignored by the larger population.
Dan Proft is our card-carrying conservative, talk show host for WLS Radio. Dan, nice to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Your reaction to this story and how it's being played and used thus far by maybe a variety of sides.
Well, it's an important story because a 17-year-old young man lost his life, so that's why it's important. It's, of course, the conversation is being denigrated and deteriorating quickly because you have race hustlers who are using this for political gain and for their own self-indulgence, Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, President Obama, the usual suspects. This is a case that's specific to a fact pattern, an individual. First he was white, then he's Hispanic, now he's white Hispanic. I don't know what that means, unless we're going to start referring to the president as white black, which the media doesn't seem intent on doing. So I don't understand the racial classification, but what it really highlights is the racial bias in the media. And for there to be this much attention on this tragic incident, I think it's an important conversation. But I hooked up my computer to one of Solyndra's solar panels and fired up the old internet and did a little searching of statistics. In the last 10 years in this country, there's been about 16,000 murders annually. 45% of the murder victims have been black men. About 90% of the perpetrators have been black men.
Of the 45%.
Of the 45%. So if you want to have a conversation, how about where are Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton and President Obama and everybody else any weekend in Chicago on the west side or south side when we have 10 African-American Easily. Children killed? They're nowhere to be found because it's only to advance a very cynical, racial-focused politics.
Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago joins us, also a native of Marks, Mississippi, so you know the sensitivity of the issue. First of all, I want to get your reaction to something Dan said. Do you agree with him when he puts Barack Obama in the same category as Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton?
I don't. I think that that Sharpton and Jackson have consistently used race, so calling them race hustlers seems appropriate. In the case of Obama, since he's become a national candidate or even a statewide candidate, he downplayed race quite significantly. In this case, however, by saying if I had a son, he would look like Trayvon, he really did take on that mantle. I would say one thing about the case, the Trayvon Martin case, that we ought to bring into the conversation right away, and that is it looks like the police investigation was slipshod and very rapid at best. And that is also an issue in the black and Hispanic communities, that they feel like when one of their own is murdered, even if it's murdered by another gang member or somebody else in their community, that they want real police work done. They don't want people to just say, oh, another one bit the dust. And that's been a problem here.
First of all, I want to get Dan just to sort of elaborate on why you put Obama into that category. Well,
this isn't the first incident. The famous beer summit, he felt the need to weigh in with Professor Gates. By the way, his associations with the most virulent racist types out there, Louis Farrakhan, Jeremiah Wright, Rashid Khalidi, I mean, Bill Ayers, for that matter. I mean, this is a long track record. This is not an isolated incident, which is why I put him in that category. He is vocal and ignorant as Sharpton and Jackson. Is he as unskilled in manipulating racial politics as those two nitwits? No, he's not, obviously. But does he have some of the same indicia of wanting to play racial politics? He absolutely does. And this is in a case where I think George Zimmerman, from what we know to this point, was wrong. He precipitated that confrontation. He should have never done that. It should have been a police matter after he called that dispatcher. So I think what we know not right now is that Trayvon Martin killing was absolutely unnecessary, and George Zimmerman bears some legal culpability based on what we know now.
But I want to talk about the response and the reaction from the African-American community, from America in general. Part of it lies in the fact that it was a senseless killing that people were agitated about. But I think the point, to go back to Dan's earlier point about violence, gang violence here in Chicago, well, that's a complex and thorny issue that you can't really point to a quick, easy solution. But what's happened here is Trayvon Martin's case, the injustice is so clear that it becomes cathartic. You see people mobilized who are traditionally have felt powerless in the face of this gang violence.
They don't have to be. I mean, you're saying it's okay to be sentimental when you want to be because you don't want to address the real problem, so the killings can continue on.
No, it's not sentimental. Let me give an example here in Chicago for the nationwide listeners. Okay, last fall, Occupy Chicago, made up of the National Nurses United Union, some teachers, some college students, tried to stay in Grant Park beyond 11 p.m. By 1 in the morning, 200 police officers, 16 on horseback, 100 police vehicles had descended on that park and arrested those people. On the south side, you don't see that manpower mobilized. And that's a failure of political will.
So you're saying it was a good thing in Grant Park?
Well, I'm saying I want to see those foot soldiers taking on the real issues. And
I wanted to talk more about that. 1-800-723. I'm sure everyone has a comment on this. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont. Back shortly from Chicago. From Terre Haute, Indiana to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8289. We'll go back to calls in just a few moments. I'll go to calls in just a few moments. Charles, I want to get back to the first question I asked. How can you have this conversation in a 24-hour news cycle world when a story like this breaks, everyone gravitates to it, again, the people that know how to use the media well, whether it's Al Sharpton or Jesse Jackson, a microphone is shoved in their face whether they want to or not, although they're usually ready, available for it.
You said whether they want to or not about Jesse Jackson?
I'm just saying. I think there was once a time I think he did decline to comment on that one. I think when the charges of his adultery came up, I think he did.
Yes.
He did decline to comment on that.
Yeah.
But my question is when and also, by the way, and we'll get into some of the things that Geraldo Rivera said because he jumped into it, and again it takes off because we live in Chicago, and again we've just shared the every single night in Chicago the lead newscasts are about someone who has been killed on the west or south sides, predominantly black areas of Chicago. Sometimes it's two or three. Night after night. For the last 3 years, it's just the situation is horrible. So when a story like this suddenly is thrust into the national spotlight, right. And again, in many cases, it's black-on-black crime. Sometimes it's obviously officer shootings involved, which again obviously raises the temperature. But in this particular case, is this Trayvon Martin story, as tragic as it is it thrust forward because Trayvon Martin looks like a fine young man? He doesn't look like a thug.
He sure didn't.
Is that the story here, which I think was sort of what I thought the president was trying to get to, is if he had a son, he could look much like this young man.
Right. I think it's an especial tragedy when a kid does everything that he's supposed to be doing in life and then is killed. It speaks to something that is every parent's nightmare and undoubtedly every black or Hispanic parent's special nightmare. Before this story became a national news story, the big story in Chicago was the shooting death of a 6-year-old Hispanic little girl. It got a huge amount of attention. This wasn't one of those, 4-year-old blonde little girl goes missing that seems to be the national news story all the time. This was just a kid who was playing in her yard or in her house or something and was killed in a gang crossfire thing. And it got a lot of city attention. And that, it seems to me, is a very typical story. The story about Trayvon Martin, it seems to me, is a reflection of something that happens now in the 24-hour news cycle and the people that they always go to. We used to refer to it in economics as Gresham's Law, where bad money drove out good money, where you had copper coins that had been devalued in the old days and they would drive out real silver or gold money. Mm-hmm. And that's what Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson and those kinds of people, the Rachel Maddows, the loudest voices, the Ed Schultz, the loudest voices. And you see this also on the cable news shows with regard to congressmen. How important is Dennis Kucinich? Zero importance. And how important actually was Michelle Bachmann? Zero importance in the Congress. The real players weren't the people who were really being talked to. It was these loudest, most shrill voices.
But in this particular case, when at least some would describe as the circumstances were egregious, let's say you cannot be outraged about every murder because then one does not stand out over the other. In this particular case, if Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson, and obviously the president elevated it way up the ladder as well, if they had not done what they're doing, which we've criticized thus far, if they had not done what they're doing, then would the Justice Department be investigating this crime at this moment?
It's hard to know.
What do you think, Mark?
I don't think so. Not at all. And I want to step back to this race hustler comment that Dan threw out earlier. I think what you're saying is those people aren't race hustlers, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton. What they're trying to do is harness this public energy towards policy ends that may actually help or prevent.
Wasn't his career built on race hustling?
Tawana Brawley.
Here's a guy who took Tawana Brawley.
He still hasn't apologized for it.
Took the facts, completely misrepresented him, and has become a national media personality.
I think there's I see where that conclusion can be easily drawn. But I think what Trayvon Martin represents Well, but these cases become emblematic for a larger problem. They're held up. In this case, the public, yes, they're outraged about Trayvon Martin, but it's a stand-in issue for a larger issue.
But it gives you
something to hold up. It gives a way to personalize the case.
Let's talk about what is the larger issue as you see it.
All right. The larger issue as I see it is this. In American society, we live in a culture of anxiety and fear. People are afraid of losing their jobs. The little material wealth they do have, they're told daily is going to be taken from them by somebody, from BP and their high gas prices, from banks that charge outrageous interest, from illegal immigrants, right, who cross the border and who are going to take your job.
And so?
So the point is this. What you see in the case of Trayvon Martin, I don't think was racist. I don't think it was racism. Now, whether or not George Zimmerman, whether or not he was racist, I think he was acting out of a fear that's about a larger anxiety in American society.
How the heck can we know? We don't know who this man is.
If you listen to the 911 call, what you hear is a person afraid. You hear Zimmerman say, they always get away with this. He doesn't see Trayvon Martin as an individual. He sees him as a they. Now, whether that they is racialized or not, I'm don't know. But if you listen to and that
by the,
call.
By the way, they're, according to the Associated Press, who have heard the tapes and interviewed people who have heard the tapes, there is some confusion. There's not a unanimity of thought as to what exactly was said.
Right.
So we don't quite know what was said in the conversation.
Sure.
Some describe it as a racial epithet. Now, let me ask you.
Yes.
Here's an important question. When you hear someone say, well, that's the way they are, is that a racial epithet?
I don't believe so. It depends on
who...
They're referring to
you?
Quite often it is.
Yeah, it can be.
Do you, Dan?
I think context is important. It could just be talking about young punks that dress like punks, and that can be white, black, Hispanic, all of the above. So I think context is really important. But I'd like to cede my time to Mark, go back to the Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton about how they're, you know, shining a light on this problem, because this is a microcosm of a larger problem, and they're trying to drive to sensible public policy, which would be great because that would be something that would be novel in their careers. So what is it exactly, the public policy solution that they're driving to with how they're behaving?
Okay. So what happens here is you want to get some people mobilized to the cause. Now, this
what cause?
To the cause of drawing attention to the inequity that still exists, the disparities in our economic system towards Hispanic and Latino people.
But how does that in this particular
George
case?
George Zimmerman was the Hispanic.
How does that come back to George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin? How does it come back? Because we don't quite know what George Zimmerman's motivations are. We know the result of the confrontation, which was tragic.
Yes.
We don't know his motivation. Again, according to published reports, there were positive things that were said about George Zimmerman, who had relations with African Americans. So this is not a known member of the Ku Klux Klan.
Right.
We do know also that maybe the local police department was not as aggressive as it should have been.
It was terrible.
We know that the Republican mayor of the town, smartly, I thought, he basically asked the police chief to step aside so cooler heads could prevail. He invited, the feds are coming in to investigate.
The state is coming in.
The state is coming, and also the Justice Department is coming in to investigate. So that should give some comfort to some African Americans in the South. Because when the Justice Department comes in, I mean, that was an important role that they played in the civil rights movement.
Yeah,
correct,
but,
Professor?
So
that is exactly right.
So there
right.
should be – this is about lowering some of the tensions. Dan?
But I mean, to Mark's point or the argument that he makes for Jackson and Sharpton – this quickly becomes what actually happened, this incident where a young man lost his life, becomes secondary. This is a proxy fight about higher corporate tax rates.
No,
it's a proxy fight about gas prices
it's
and
not,
big oil.
No.
I mean, it's nonsense.
No.
That is nonsense.
No, it's this, Dan.
Let me finish. And to the extent that this is what they want to use, they want to use the death of a young man to prosecute their larger redistributionist war on America – is insulting. And it is
like
and it is despicable to the death of that young man and to the larger issue of violence in minority communities, particularly African American community.
Okay, thank you for saying that, but here's the truth, Dan. Trayvon Martin is symbolic of every young African American, Hispanic, white male that's been slain from gang violence in the United States whose death has not been investigated because of shoddy police work. Had George Zimmerman not been a neighborhood watch person, had he just been a man who came up and shot him, I think this story would not be happening. It's that George Zimmerman, the neighborhood watch, gives him a pseudo law enforcement persona.
Right. And so it's part of an agenda also to get guns out of the hands of private citizens. It'll be part of a big agenda.
Well,
and
it's also
this, I think you're saying that.
Of course
on
it will.
That
well,
we
stand,
all agree.
Well, also, it's also going to bring into focus the Stand Your Ground law in Florida and about a dozen other states, which basically.
Although the people who wrote that law say it does not apply here.
Okay.
Yeah, but I actually agree that statute needs to be tightened up because it does create ambiguity in this case.
Yes. And that is a legitimate goal of this whole conversation that I think everybody could agree needs some tightening up. Back shortly from Chicago with phone calls. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us this evening. Mark Casello is here. He is our card-carrying liberal. He is an associate professor in English from Calumet College of St. Joseph. Also, he has been an observer for the Occupy Chicago movement. And again, we'll be talking about that a little bit later on in the broadcast. And also, we'll have you back a couple of times before the big march to Chicago coming up in late May. Dan Proft also joins us. Once upon a time, he ran in the Republican gubernatorial primary. He did not do well in that race. However, you impressed a lot of people, so much so that you have your own talk show with Bruce Wolf every day, Monday through Friday, on our flagship station, WLS Radio in Chicago, and a regular guest on this program for almost 20 years. You realize? Almost 20
years? 40.
I started when I was 6.
I'm 26 years old. That's good. Pretty close. I'll have to look that up. Also joining us is the ever-popular pride of Marks, Mississippi, Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago. Charles, always nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Bruce.
We're going to go to calls in just a moment. But, again, we've been talking about what Al Sharpton and what Jesse Jackson has had to say and another member of this media circus that is emerging is Geraldo Rivera. He, too, is not shy when it comes to appearing before microphones and frequently putting his foot in his mouth. This is what he had to say, and I want to spend a moment talking about this in context with what I asked at the beginning of the program. Can we have, in this country, can we have a discussion of race without being criticized for what we say? And this is what he said. Trayvon Martin, God bless him, an innocent kid, a wonderful kid, a box of Skittles in his hands. He didn't deserve to die. But I bet your money, if he didn't have that hoodie on, that nutty neighborhood watch guy wouldn't have responded in that violent and aggressive way. I am urging the parents of blacks and Latino youngsters, particularly, not to let their children go out wearing hoodies. I think the hoodie is as much responsible for Trayvon Martin's death as much as George Zimmerman was. Geraldo Rivera of Fox News. Charles, your reaction to this discussion by...
Well, subtract 10 points from his IQ. That, it seems to me, is just ludicrous. It may be that in some areas having a hoodie is an identifier, a gang identifier, but it's just silly. He may have meant well in saying, please don't identify yourselves in ways that are sort of clearly would send signals of menace to other people. But that's not the problem here. That's really not what the problem was, Bruce.
What do you think, Mark?
It's the old blame the victim type of story that you hear when women are raped and they were asking for it. It's that same type of logic that I don't think really is appropriate for this instance.
But does it raise fear in the part of, again, I don't want to put say it raises the fear of George Zimmerman because we don't know. But would that, a group of youngsters, whether they're black, white, whatever the color they may be, if they're wearing hoodies or they've got their pants down to their butt cracks and they look like they're from a gangsta area,
well, what,
their dress, does that, do people react to that look?
Of course they do. Sure.
Okay.
Of course they do.
But isn't this similar to the story, I think it was Juan Williams who said that, Muslims on planes make him nervous. Was that?
The fact is, we do send signals to other people with the way we dress, the way we walk. There are, you know, and people want to send those signals. That's why they wear high heels and they wear other things. But I think that you were right initially, Mark, when you were saying there's a kind of he was trying to be nice to him individually, but I think talking about this had a blame the victim quality. To it.
But again, my point is this. Can you say that? Because Geraldo has been castigated for saying this. And I am not a big Geraldo Rivera fan. I've had a personal experience with him. I'm not a fan of his. But in this particular case, is this overkill? Is this someone, even if he said something unfortunate, there's an element of this that maybe is somewhat exploratory.
I heard a comedian a few weeks ago saying that, or maybe it was a columnist saying we all need to take insensitivity training. Everybody just seems so hypersensitive to every single thing being an irritation and an insult.
I mean, Geraldo, he could say it. It's an absurd statement. So that redounds to the detriment of Geraldo, and it doesn't advance the conversation at all. I agree with Mark. It's like saying a woman had a short skirt on, so she was asking to be raped. It is absolute nonsense. We discussed this on our show in the morning, and we had one woman text us saying, I'm a 52-year-old woman, white woman wearing a hoodie, and I'm not a thug. I'm going to the gym. The idea, how people dress, how they talk, does that kind of give off signals? Do people judge that? Of course they judge that. But ultimately, you hold people accountable for their behavior, not their fashion sense.
Right. That's exactly
it
right.
It does remind me of an instance. I teach in a very diverse college, one of the most diverse in the Midwest. And I was teaching a class and having a discussion about the use of proper English. And one of my students said, do you mean you want me to talk white? And I said, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that there is a discourse, there is a code of language that you can switch to in the professional world that happens to be used by the ruling majority in our the hegemonic language or dialect in America, which is proper English. But it gets to this question, is a hoodie necessarily black clothing, and does that indicate that you're a criminal? No, certainly not.
And by the way, the dominating class and the hegemonic language, I don't like to use synergy and all the other corporate buzz speak all the time either when I'm talking to people.
Sure.
So, I mean, transcends race.
But I think what we're getting here to is the idea of code switching in our appearance, right? Tonight, we're wearing suits. Had we come in hoodies, you know, Bruce would have told me to go home. Told us to go home, right? So
no,
but,
not this week.
Right.
I was almost going to wear a hoodie tonight.
Right.
But I think Geraldo's point was if he was walking down the street and he had a Ralph Lauren shirt on, he would have been viewed differently.
And I look at
so
Mark,
appearance is part of it.
Mark is walking around constantly now with this Rick Santorum vest on, and I just think that. It's needless, Mark. It's needless.
You do not have
to join this hegemonic discourse.
He's trying to impersonate a Republican, and I don't appreciate
it. Right, Mark.
I want to feel the loathing that Rick Santorum
feels.
Let's
take a moment here because we've touched on a subject because it does get to at least part of what Geraldo was talking about is that appearance, no less a person than Jesse Jackson said several years ago that he understood why some white people are threatened when a group of blacks approach them. He even said that he would walk on the other side of the street if that happened in many neighborhoods. And based on what? Is it based on the color of their skin? Possibly. Is it based on the way they look? And so if you've got the baggy pants, you are perceived differently by what you wear. And I would just say, and again, I don't think that this is necessarily a, you know, a conspiracy, you know, or a planned thought that you had as you prepare for the show. And again, for those people who are listening to this program, we're also a local television show. So when people make reference to things of a visual nature, you sort of understand that wherever you're listening around the country. But you're dressed up tonight. Mm-hmm. You look terrific for television. But you are also coming to a table, and by the way, everyone has a shirt and tie on tonight and a jacket, except myself. I never wear a jacket. However, in your particular case, you are carrying a message that is far to the left of everyone else at this table. Mm-hmm. In many cases, people who carry that message don't care too much about the way they look. Mm-hmm. You look terrific tonight. Mm-hmm. You're carrying a message. You will be more believed by more people, mm-hmm, because of the way you look for those people watching this television show, mm-hmm, than if you came in wearing a hoodie or a t-shirt, and some of your professorial friends who appear on this show sometimes do. Right. And they're taken less seriously.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. But I don't agree with Geraldo in this case.
I think, first, Mark, you clean up really good. And I think we can all agree to that. The people listening on radio can't see the banana hat that he's wearing, but it does detract from the things Bruce was saying.
Let's go to a call. Bonnie in Four Seasons, Indiana. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. You know, they had just said in the news before your show started that the attorney representing Mr. Zimmerman said that all the facts are not out. He said his client had a broken nose and all kinds of, you know, injuries and stuff, and he said that that will come out. Now, whether or not we believe that or not, I'm thinking the media needs to do a better job of being journalists. They're supposed to be neutral. Now, you know, and it's very likely that what happened was what happened.
But don't you think that the story, what the news is reporting, what the news is now reporting is what Jesse Jackson is saying, and what the new Black Panthers are threatening death, and that's become the story.
Please let me finish. I'm getting to Jesse Jackson. So, first of all, you got the media who's determining guilt and innocence here. Then you have the media giving credibility to people like Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, and these guys are, you know, these morally challenged, churchless pseudo-reverends who make their pronouncements but then don't address ever issues in their own community. And then getting to the Zimmerman guy.
Bonnie, let me interrupt you. We're going to a break. I'm going to put you on hold. I'm going to give you an opportunity to continue your conversation because I know you've waited a long time. Stay right where you are. We'll hear more from you when we roll on from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We continue with Bonnie from Four Seasons, Indiana. And Bonnie, you were about to continue your conversation.
Well, thank you. You know, it's more like a diatribe. no, but I mean, I'm thinking this guy is being essentially tried in the media, with the media in the court of public opinion. And if it ever does get to trial, he'll be able to say, well, I can't get a fair trial because I've essentially been convicted already. And then you've got the media also, you know, shoving the microphones in the faces of Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, who claim they represent the Black community, and, you know, and they've got their own morally challenged issues. And then you've got this guy who claims to be a neighborhood watchman, and I'm thinking, who appointed him anyway? And if he really was watching, wouldn't he have known that the kid was a neighbor of his?
Well, he was, as I understand it, he was visiting his father, so he was not a permanent resident of that area. He was visiting his father and his fiancée.
Trayvon was.
Yes.
Well, Bruce,
he might not have known.
This guy should have still known, because, I mean, you typically see your parents occasionally, and the kid would have been a visitor to the area before. And that this guy, you know,
What we're talking about here is we're talking about the basic crux to this case right now. We know one thing. The victim is African American and 17 years old. The person who...
Unarmed.
Unarmed and doing nothing and wrong.
Doing nothing. He was walking home from a convenience store with some Skittles in his hand. And at least according to the pictures that were that have been offered, he looked... He did not look like a gang member, other than he had a hoodie on, which some people might have perceived in a negative way. George Zimmerman was 28 years old. According to at least what we know now, there was nothing in his background to indicate that he was racist in any way.
And
he's
half Hispanic.
A mixture of Hispanic and white.
Descent.
And at this particular point, there's some allegations that in the call that went to the police department, a racial epithet allegedly was stated. Allegedly, there's discrepancy about how you whether you heard something in that call or not. No one has played the tape, so everybody can hear it. And what we are left with, which we don't know right now, unless we focus on interpretations from people that might have an ulterior motive, is what happened when George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin met.
Yeah, but what happened? But the crux of the case is they should have never met. He precipitated the confrontation. He was called off by
Zimmerman.
Zimmerman did. He was called off by dispatch. The police will handle it from here, and he continued on. So whatever happened when Zimmerman confronted Trayvon Martin should have never happened in the first place.
Why did it become a national case, Bruce? I mean,
why did it
Dan,
become a national case?
Why did it become
well, because
a national
he,
case,
he,
Dan?
He
I think one of the
next step.
I think one of the reasons it became a national case is because he pursued him.
Right, but I mean, there were a lot of people. Last night there was somebody shot at Mississippi State University. It looks like a group of kids from Jackson, Mississippi, may have been gang-related, came over, shot some kid. There was another kid shot. I mean, you know, last night in Chicago, a bunch of people. Why, of all the people who were shot, has this resonated so much?
Well, of course. It's like the Gina 6 in Louisiana. And it turned out when the facts came in, boy, it was a lot different than what it was originally reported in terms of these six individuals.
I'd like to ask the caller
a
question.
So the race issue is obviously mission critical here.
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead.
Well, the caller is from Four Seasons in Indiana. That's a gated community. This took place in a gated community. I was just curious. Is the caller still on the line? Or
no, she's gone.
But I'm just curious to hear maybe from some callers who live in gated communities. Do they have a neighborhood watch or a local area? To what extent? I mean, in a gated community, right, there's a sense of that somebody who's in this neighborhood belongs here.
Right, because you've had to – people live in gated communities because they don't believe that the local environment is safe enough. They want people to either have to go past a person to get into the community or to get past a gate. So that they're trying in a private way to make up for the social failings of the community.
So if Trayvon Martin is in the neighborhood, it suggests that he belonged there.
But in this sense,
Zimmerman had called police 46 times, too, about other incidents. So this wasn't the first time he had
Ryan
been
Wolf.
You know, playing Hawkeye and calling police about whatever he thought was you know, not appropriate or somebody who was in the neighborhood who shouldn't have been.
So as you explain this, Dan, in your view then, in the case of George Zimmerman, he acted not improperly?
Yeah, he acted improperly in pursuing Trayvon Martin.
Yeah,
yeah. In my mind, with what we know right now, I don't even think it's a close call.
Acted properly in calling the police and improperly in what he did afterwards from what we know now.
Right. So then the brouhaha is legitimate.
Wait a minute. Part of the brouhaha is legitimate. Part of the brouhaha is designed, as Mark was saying, he was positive about it, but you could be negative, to advance larger political agendas.
So do you believe, again, we're getting into speculation now, your general perception is that he perceived him because he was black then?
I have no idea.
It's hard to tell. I would say this. From the call, they say, are you following him? Zimmerman replies, yes, and they say, we don't need you to do that. When he goes beyond that, that's where it becomes the problem.
Okay, so he's called off by the police.
Right.
The Justice Department is investigating, and all the facts will be known, hopefully, sooner than later.
And an independent investigator from the state of Florida is doing it.
And as Jesse Jackson would say, the white part of him is the racist part. The Hispanic part, that was not the racist part.
On that note, we are out of time for hour number one. Mark Casello has been with us. He is our card-carrying liberal. Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago also joins us. Dan Proctor, card-carrying conservative veteran talk show host, a guest and talk show host on WLS Radio. If you survived 13 weeks in this business, you're a veteran. On that note, we are out of time for hour number one of our broadcast. If you're watching us on television, we'll see you next week. If you're listening to us on radio, we're going to look ahead to campaign 2012. Talk a little bit about some slip-ups in the Romney campaign, the win yesterday in Louisiana by Rick Santorum, and a whole bunch of things on the political front, as well as some problems that Barack Obama is having raising money. All that coming up in the next hour of Beyond the Beltway. If you're listening to us coast to coast on radio, I'm Bruce Dumont. Back shortly. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Tonight featuring commentary by Republican Dan Proft, Democrat Mark Casello, and Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago. Our phone lines open at 1-800-723-8289. Rick Santorum did well, as expected, in Louisiana yesterday. Last Tuesday, Mitt Romney did very well in the state of Illinois. That was a big win for him, so he's doing well in the Midwestern primaries. And as expected, Santorum did well yesterday in Louisiana. Rick Santorum, 49% of the vote. Mitt Romney, 26.7. Newt Gingrich finishing a bad third at 15.9%. Ron Paul, 6.2%. By the way, Newt Gingrich in Illinois finished fourth, which was very embarrassing. If I was the former Speaker of the House, that would certainly be embarrassing to me. The Republican delegate count as of this moment, Mitt Romney at 565, Rick Santorum at 256, Newt at 141, Ron Paul at 66, and I think by everyone should know by now, 1144 needed for the nomination. But one moment this past week put Mitt Romney in a defensive mode, and that was when one of his senior staffers, advisors,
his communications director.
He did a good job of getting himself in the news. And of course, the people that surround presidential candidates, and whether they're Republicans or Democrats, they come from they're cut from the same cloth. They can't help. They want to take credit for things before they even happen. And they frequently say really dumb things. And Eric Fernstrom said, senior spokesman for the Romney campaign, said, quote, I think he was being asked about inconsistency between the primary and whether or not some of the things that Mitt Romney is saying in the primary is going to hurt him in the general election. And then he said, quote, I think you hit the reset button for the fall campaign. Everything changes. It's almost like an etch-a-sketch. You can kind of shake it all up and start all over again, end of quote. And, of course, that was music to the ears of the Democrats, to the Santorum people, to the national campaign. Why do people who advise presidential campaigns, why can't they keep their mouth shut? And why do they always say something stupid? I mean, frequently, about three or four, this will happen. Some other advisor throughout this campaign is going to say something stupid. But Eric...
Right. We were talking before we went on about Christina Romer, the economic advisor to President Obama when he first came in. She was the one who said, you pass the stimulus, we'll get unemployment under 8%. That wasn't President Obama. That was an advisor. That will happen. Let me say why I think it resonates, Bruce. Who is the most athletic and competent physically of the presidents we've had in the last 50 years? Gerald Ford. He played college-level football and all the rest. And what was our image of Gerald Ford? Tripping as he gets off of an airplane. Why does it resonate? Because that was what people thought about the Ford presidency, for better or for worse. That's what they thought at the time.
Chevy Chase thought that. Mm-hmm.
Chevy Chase thought that. Jimmy Carter with those dumb sweaters sitting in front. It captured what people's views of the person were. And the problem and the reason this won't simply disappear like a sketch on an Etch-a-Sketch for Romney is it taps in to what people's fears are, both his supporters and his opponents. They fear that there's no core there, that he will just shake it and restart it.
Dan?
Look, it was sloppy language. It was an inopportune metaphor. I think as candidates, as well as Flax, message discipline is something that's repeated all the time because it's difficult. Even the Flax get tired of saying the same thing over and over again, so they want to say it in a different way just to keep it interesting for themselves.
But why does it resonate, Dan?
Well, I think this resonates for what you're saying. I agree with you, Charles, that this resonates because Mitt Romney still has this authenticity hurdle to clear among wide swaths, certainly of the Republican primary electorate. And so there is a purposeful desire to interpret this in a way that is least flattering to Romney instead of sure. really understanding what his spokesman was saying, which is, look, you have a primary, then you have a general. The dynamic's completely different. It's a completely different race, which is really what he was trying to say. It's he's admitting that Mitt Romney is going to jettison everything he said in the primary and adopt a whole new value system in the general, and that's just silliness.
Well, there's one thing Romney will not get rid of in the general election, and that's the contention that the trees are the right height in Michigan. He's going to stick to that one, but
important. But remember how.
And by the way, has the stock price on Etch a Sketch gone up?
It has.
Oh, I'm sure.
It went way up.
All
and
the
their
Democrats
sales
are
vastly
buying.
And Etch a Sketch keychains that were being passed.
But
out.
Remember how with Kerry, what
like
stock,
the loafers or the
remember the line,
flip flops.
Remember the line though that stuck with Kerry. I was for it before I was against it. Or I was against it before I was for it. I mean, you know, nobody could remember, and that was this flip flop.
Yeah, but that was a flip flop. It was on the seminal issue of the war,
yes,
and that was Kerry saying it.
It was Kerry saying it. But the point is, these things stick when they resonate with the way that somebody has a fear about it.
But the Etch-a-Sketch comment was also unfortunate, and I've heard this reported, I have to confirm it myself, but that Bain Capital moved Ohio Arts production facility from America and outsourced it. That was one of Romney's moves in consolidations.
Oh.
The actual company that makes
the
Etch-a-Sketch.
You are down in the weeds, man.
Wow. Well,
he must be a graduate of the David Axelrod Institute for Skullduggery at Charles's.
I have a fellowship.
Yes.
I'm an apprentice there.
Well, that's a good piece of news.
Yeah. Good dig.
What does it take for Newt Gingrich to get out of this race? And if there was a one-on-one with Romney, do you think it would make any difference?
Yeah, I don't know what it takes for Newt to get out, you know, for all the obvious reasons about Newt. I mean, he said that after the primary season is over, he wants to have a 60-day national conversation with the Republican Party leading into the convention. That's probably just more of Newt's grandiosity. But I think he has a real opportunity to take advantage of how he has refurbished his brand during this campaign cycle, from where he started and the rocky start he got to his ascendancy and then to now where he finds himself having plateaued and having no more primary victories on the horizon. I think he can still be a player, but the longer he kind of goes through these primary states with barely a whimper, I think the less influence he has.
That's why I felt embarrassed for him when he finished fourth in Illinois.
Yeah,
here's a guy who legitimately is going to be in the history books. 100 years from now, Newt Gingrich will be in the history books because of what he did. Mm-hmm. And to me, he squandered that moment, that role in history, literally by staying a little bit longer than he needed. And when you finish fourth, it's not that's just embarrassing.
It's not just that he's finishing low. It's that he increasingly looks grumpy. Mm-hmm. It's personal. The big ideas that he claims are his strength are not what he's putting out. It's $2.50 gas is his one line now. So I think where he stops is when he can, although he can continue to fly Southwest to the next campaign, I don't see him doing any better than third anywhere, and he won't have any money to go on the air. And at some point, he's got to withdraw.
I think it's going to go all the way to California. It could be like Goldwater. I think Romney maybe puts it over the top at the very end. Back shortly from Chicago with a report from Wisconsin. Bruce Dumont back. It is April, a week from Tuesday, is the big primary up in Wisconsin, which is one of the next big, at least major states that people are going to be looking at. And yesterday, Rick Santorum, although he was winning in Louisiana, he was spending his time in Milwaukee looking ahead to try to find an upset, try to find a Midwest Great Lakes state that he can best Mitt Romney. And joining us now to talk about what she saw at that speech yesterday is Stephanie Lecce. She is the coordinating producer of Lake Effect on the Milwaukee Public Radio Station, WUWM, and a former producer of this program. So, Stephanie, welcome back to Beyond the Beltway as a guest.
Hey there, Bruce. Nice to speak with you today.
What did you observe yesterday? What sort of response did Rick Santorum get in Milwaukee?
He got an excellent response. It was certainly interesting. He was speaking at the Americans for Prosperity Foundation's Defending the American Dream Summit, and there were about 1,000 conservative activists there. And they certainly were responsive to his message. And I heard you guys before the break talking about Mitt Romney's Etch-a-Sketch or his campaign spokesperson's Etch-a-Sketch moment. That was definitely something that Senator Santorum brought up during his remarks.
And as you look at the primary, where does the primary stand insofar as the recall for Governor Walker, insofar as what the average person on the street in Wisconsin is talking about?
Well, people are certainly seeing a connection. Several of the voters who I spoke to after the Santorum speech talked about how they felt that Senator Santorum made a case for connecting himself with Governor Scott Walker. In fact, he even went on to say during his speech that, you know, being from Pennsylvania, he knows that there are no tougher bullies than public employee unions. And he said directly to the governor, "I am for you, I am behind you, and I will do everything I can to make sure you stay governor." So clearly Santorum was trying to connect himself with a very popular and divisive issue here in the state.
What sort of activity has there been for Romney in the state? How often has he been there?
He hasn't yet. I believe that the first time he'll be here is next Saturday, March 31st. The Wisconsin Faith and Freedom Coalition is going to be hosting a presidential kickoff. Romney, Gingrich, and Santorum are all confirmed to be there, but I believe that marks Romney's first time in the state.
And looking at the other elected officials in the state, have they weighed in on this race?
On the presidential race?
Yeah.
Certainly Governor Walker has voiced his support for Rick Santorum, but I believe most people are kind of staying out of that. They're really focused here on the recall election.
Mm-hmm. And what about the newspapers? Have they made an endorsement yet?
I'm not 100% sure on that. I apologize.
Okay. When you look at the – I want to just ask a couple of questions, and I think Mark has got some questions also, and as does Professor Charles Lipson, who you certainly know well. Dan Proft also joins us. What is the mood right now in that recall election? If it was tomorrow, what would happen?
Honestly, I can't tell you. As far as the polls go, it's kind of a dead heat. Whatever advantage Governor Walker stands against the three different Democratic challengers who will face a primary on May 8th, it all falls within the margin of error. So it really is anybody's game. That said, there's a lot of money being pumped into this election. Former Dane County Executive Kathleen Falk actually has an organization not connected with her campaign, but it's basically a union front organization that has started pretty much a media blitz here in the state. And many people, including Governor Walker, are questioning the union money and the fact that it's coming in from outside of the state.
Now, one of the other candidates in that race is Tom Barrett, the mayor of Milwaukee, who ran and lost to Walker. Who's the third person in that race?
Mayor Barrett has said that he's going to announce before April 3rd, as far as I know. I don't know that he's actually officially announced. The other candidates are State Senator Kathleen Vinehout and Secretary of State Doug LaFollette.
LaFollette is always a popular name in that state. Mark, you have a question.
Sure. I just had a question. In Louisiana, the exit polls for Santorum showed that he was really pushing social issues. How did his message change? Did he tailor his message to the Wisconsin voters? What seem to be the issues he thinks are going to win Wisconsin for him?
He talked a lot about individual liberty and limited government, which certainly are issues that are coming up, that are themes that we're hearing a lot with this recall election. A lot of people took issue with Governor Walker curtailing public employees' powers, collective bargaining rights. And, you know, his argument was that this was necessary for the budget, but a lot of people say that it was also an opportunity. A couple of voters I spoke to who were actually public employee union members were excited by the fact that with Governor Walker's changes, they could then have the option whether to join the unions or not. So that individual liberty component is very important. In terms of the other social issues, one of the lines that Senator Santorum said during his remarks that got the most applause was he said, they want someone who identifies with them, who doesn't say at fundraisers in San Francisco about these people clinging to their guns and their Bibles. You're darn right we cling to our guns and our Bible because we believe in those things. That was a real statement that got a lot of applause and a long-standing ovation from the audience. So clearly the social issues are attracting voters.
Certainly do. Rick Santorum, go ahead, Charles.
Yes, Mark really touched on the issue that struck me. It's been Santorum has really been seemed to have gotten a strong economic message, and then for the last several weeks has been completely about social issues. I don't know if that was off message or a quite deliberate choice. My question is, how does the Republican electorate in the state of Wisconsin look? Santorum hasn't won very many states that don't have this very large Christian, conservative, evangelical dimension that really wants to vote for him on social issues. In Illinois, where that's a smaller percentage, Romney did very well, and indeed won half of the Tea Party vote. What does it look like in Wisconsin?
Well, I'll tell you that Santorum certainly brought up economic issues here in his speech. He talked about the need to create jobs, and he hit both Barack Obama and Mitt Romney on those issues in terms of the importance of creating energy jobs. And I thought it was interesting that he mentioned energy jobs here in Wisconsin, where recently a mining bill failed to go through the state legislature. That was a job that Governor Walker and some Republicans argued would create a lot of jobs in the state, where we are suffering a relatively high unemployment rate. So I thought it was interesting that he should make those remarks about energy jobs at a time when jobs is dominating the statewide conversation.
Mitt Romney, I think, according to the last poll I saw, which was about a week ago, is up about 15 points in the race right now. I mean, how does this shake out when he comes into that state and he starts to saturate the airwaves like he did in Illinois? I would expect that electorate in Wisconsin, actually probably even more progressive than the Republican electorate in Illinois, I would see it shaking out the same.
Yep.
It'll be interesting.
He's all over TV. I was in Milwaukee over the weekends, all over TV.
And you know, Romney won all the counties in Illinois that were bordering, or won most of the counties that were bordering Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Santorum will likely do well in the more rural counties, but it'll be interesting to see what shakes out in Waukesha County, which is kind of the harbinger of the Republican mood in the state. So you'll see, you know, Where Waukesha County goes, I would suspect the state. state will go in terms of Romney versus Santorum. That said, even though Romney did have that lead in that last poll, it is interesting to note that Santorum did beat him in two polls back in February here in the state. Mm-hmm. So once he comes into the state at the end of this month, it'll be interesting, given the amount of money that he has.
Well, he also has a challenge coming up in late May when he goes back to Pennsylvania. I mean, the other candidates have won their home states, at least, you know, Romney has several home states, and Gingrich one is. So it's now time for Santorum to win win in Pennsylvania, and that may not be a foregone conclusion. Here's a guy who, when he last ran there, lost by 18 points. He's ticked off a lot of Republican establishment in that state, including the incumbent Republican senator,
right,
because he endorsed Arlen Specter in a primary a couple of years ago, and then it's going to be also going on. I mean, the big story in that state is going to be, you know, the trial of Jerry Sandusky, and it's going to bring up some issues. I think the comments that were made last week on this program, not wanting to talk about, you know, he wants to talk about pornography and the job that Obama is doing, charging the Obama administration with being soft on pornography, and yet his own track record of speaking out on that issue was not very strong when he had the opportunity to do so.
Yeah, my sense is that when he brings up those issues, there's a wing of the Democratic Party that's all about being bossy. They want us to drive a Prius and never smoke another cigarette and so forth. And there's a wing of the Republican Party that's extremely bossy, and it wants us to never access pornography and all the rest. These are social issues, and my sense is that these are just losers on a national scale for both the Democrats and the Republicans.
By the way, the primary is April 24th. I think I said in May up there. So, again, if you were looking to your crystal ball, you would say at this particular moment probably a slight edge to Romney in that primary on April 3rd up in Wisconsin?
It'll definitely be interesting, but I would assume once he actually comes to the state, even though Santorum has had the head start, the amount of money that the Romney campaign has and the amount of media exposure he'll be able to get could tip the scales in his favor. A lot of the voters I talked to, while they liked Santorum's conservative message, talked about how they wanted a candidate who could beat Obama, and it seems to be the consensus that it's Romney.
All right, on that note, we are going to say farewell to you. That's Stephanie Lecce. She is the coordinating producer of Lake Effect on WUWM. That's Milwaukee Public Radio reporting on the speech yesterday in Milwaukee by Rick Santorum. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us this evening around the table. We have Dan Proft. He is our Republican tonight, and he is a talk show host for our flagship station, WLS Radio, for a long, long time, a frequent guest on this program as well. Democrat is Mark Casello. He is an associate English professor at Calumet College of St. Joseph's, and Charles Lipson joins us from the University of Chicago, where he's been a political science professor for a long time. Let's go back to some calls. Let's go to Joe, listening to us in Waukegan, Illinois, on our flagship station, WLS, the radio home of Bruce Wolf and Dan Proft. Go ahead.
Good evening. Put it to you this way. Who is the easiest of the three, Romney, Santorum, or Gingrich, for Ron Paul to knock off if Ron Paul were to run as a third-party candidate?
Ron Paul. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I think Romney is the easiest. He's not a committed conservative, and he will depress the Republican turnout. The Ron Paul followers will go with Ron Paul, whereas they might go with, in preference to Romney, whereas they might go with Gingrich or Santorum in order to prevent Obama from getting back in.
I think it's all a kind of a dream scenario. Let me say why, Joe. My sense is that Ron Paul is not going to run. It was a genuine threat in the early going. I think it's one of the reasons besides the fact that Romney actually personally seems to like Ron Paul, that he didn't attack him. He didn't want to do to him what happened with Gingrich, which is to sort of paint him into a corner and create a third party. I think the other reason is that Ron Paul has a son who is a rising star in the Republican Party, and if Ron Paul runs as a third-party candidate, he's burning bridges not for himself. This will be his last go-round at this dance, but for his son. So my sense is that it'll be mano a mano between Romney and President Obama in the general election.
I agree with that. I agree with that, but I'd say one other thing. Romney, or whoever the Republican nominee is, and it will be Romney, so I'll just say Romney, needs to make an explicit appeal to make sure that not that Ron Paul runs as a third party candidate, because I don't think he's going to do it, as Charles, and for some of the reasons Charles articulated, but he needs those Ron Paul voters not to just stay home. Forget going somewhere else. They need to come out. They need to be part of the Republican Party's center right governing coalition. Those libertarian oriented Republicans need to be part of it.
Are you one of those voters, Joe? Are you a Ron Paul voter?
Forget Ron Paul for the moment. Fill him in with any generic hardcore conservative nominee.
Mm-hmm.
A hardcore conservative nominee will draw off more votes from Romney than he would from Gingrich or Santorum. That's how the game is played. You put out a liberal like Ralph Nader to draw off votes from whoever the Democrat is. You put out a conservative or a pseudo-conservative like Ross Perot to draw off votes from whoever the Republican nominee is.
Well,
that's how it works. Well, it's the spoiler game.
Well, that's right. But if there is no third-party candidate, which I don't think there's going to be, at least not one of consequence, then the challenge for Romney is going to be, again, making an explicit appeal to bring Ron Paul voters into his camp, even if they're not totally sold, that they at least buy the "we got to end Obama's reign."
I also think
Paul's already slammed Romney as no different from Obama.
No, I also think something else, you know, I was the one that said that, you know, if Ron Paul is going to run, he should run. People, you know, if he has the guts to do it, there's some prices to pay. He may be paying a price for his son. He may not want to do that. But also looking, and by the way, in every debate, I've always been impressed by Ron Paul. But then voters vote. Ron Paul cannot ever say he has not had an opportunity to present his case to the American people and to the American primary voters. He has. He's been on television not more than the other candidates, but he's been treated fairly and squarely, I think, in most of the debates, certainly in the recent debates. And the fact is, he runs third or fourth. So I think that he's you know, the fear of the Ron Paul vote, that vote may not be that large.
It wouldn't
You're
have
part
to
of
be,
it.
Though.
People who talk to talk shows.
It wouldn't
shows.
Have to be, Bruce.
In
some, it could
in
be
some
like
states.
Nader. In the very close states, if you drained off 2 or 3%, and they would be coming from the Republican nominee for president, that could be enough to switch it. You wouldn't have to have 19% like Ross Perot.
But what about if he starts talking about his libertarian views, his views on drugs and the war on drugs and the foreign policy? I think people could be leaving Barack Obama. There could be people leaving Barack Obama because, you know what, they think that when Ron Paul says he thinks that our foreign policy sucks, there's a lot of people on the left, right? You're nodding your head.
Yeah, he's closer to the views of the far left on military
policy. But the point is that so the people that are voting in Republican primaries now for Ron Paul, this is my point, is that constituency, Ron Paul, if he wants to advance the interests of his son long term and, frankly, the interests of this country short term and long term, then he needs to do whatever he can to bring that constituency over, because it could matter in key swing states. I mean, New Mexico elected Gary Johnson governor twice.
Yeah.
You know, there are people that have that sensibility that could have an impact in states that are important.
I would say that one issue that we haven't brought up yet, I think if Romney becomes the nominee, which seems likely, is that you're running a multimillionaire in a time of great economic peril for most people. And I think while the rising gas prices are going to be a terrible thorn in Obama's side, ultimately, if Mitt Romney is the nominee, that narrative, a multimillionaire, is just not going to appeal, I think, to a lot of working-class Republican voters.
Yeah, except Mitt Romney has a great comeback to that charge, which is, I was a multimillionaire before I got into politics. Barack Obama became a multimillionaire after he got into politics. Big difference.
Sure, but he speaks to a sort of privilege that most Americans don't enjoy.
He should own it. He
but
should,
aspire
there's
to.
No, there's nothing,
but
wrong, aspire with, there's to. Nothing there's, wrong with success. He should own it as opposed
have,
to apologize for it.
You have President Obama, who's come from a single-parent family, worked his way up. He's a model of the American dream versus Romney, who was born into wealth and privilege.
I think that
and
they,
has trouble connecting with I the think average
you're
He
has right. trouble you're connecting, right. but it's not because he was born in, it's not because of anything he's done. He has not been a silver spoon guy who hasn't worked for a living.
Ask Mitt Romney how much a box of macaroni and cheese
costs.
This is
the old George Herbert Walker Bush thing, how much, you know, he didn't know what the grocery store scanner was.
I was talking to my chauffeur the other day, and he just says that the price of mac and cheese has really hardly changed at all. And I.
But why would, by the way, first of all, Stephanie Lecce called back, and Governor Walker of Wisconsin has not endorsed Rick Santorum. I think that came out in one of the interviews. She called back to correct that. So I wanted to get on.
My sense is that the issue with Romney is that his being a multimillionaire is a problem only because it reinforces the problem that he doesn't exactly connect. So it was the same problem that Kerry had, but that Ted Kennedy didn't have. Ted Kennedy had it all handed to him with a silver spoon.
Right, right. So did John Kerry.
Yes, but what's the difference between Ted Kennedy and John Kennedy on the one hand and Kerry on the other? It was that the Kennedys seemed to be able to connect with ordinary people. It wasn't the money. It was, and Kerry did not. Kerry seemed to always be on his own yacht.
I agree, and I think part of Romney's inability to connect is he can't get his hands or his mind around how he wants to present his wealth to the American people. And instead of apologizing for it, which he falls back on all too often, he should own it, be proud of it. We're an aspirational society. I did very well. I'm very fortunate.
Well,
he doesn't have to.
And look, he did it.
He did it working.
He did it on his own.
Jobs and creating wealth,
but articulating it. You look at the Florida debate.
Right,
he did it in the Florida debate.
Did it.
He hasn't done it in every debate, but he took that. He took
That's
that question.
Right.
Let me say one more thing about Romney. He should get off this debate too. What he should say is own it and then pivot to this thing he said in Illinois in his acceptance speech or his victory speech in Illinois, which he didn't develop yet, but he needs to develop because it's a great contrast opportunity.
Yes,
I believe in the American people, and that's not just the throwaway line if you develop it, because I believe in the American people in this sense. That you can achieve for yourself what you desire. Barack Obama doesn't believe it. The left doesn't believe it. They believe in big government, and they believe you can only achieve, number one, what they say you're allowed to achieve, and number two, only with their help. That is a big difference.
Okay, couple points here responding to Dan. First, Mitt Romney, when he comes out, he says, my wife drives a couple of Cadillacs. Many Americans are struggling to put gas into their rotting, rusting car, barely making their insurance payments, just trying to get by. So when you say, my wife drives a couple of Cadillacs, yeah, you're winning the vote of the GM board, but not the general public. Secondly,
what about the people that make those Cadillacs? That's not a bad thing to say in Detroit.
No, but it's a 10-year.
I understand.
And what about the guy blocking the Keystone Pipeline?
Sure.
Maybe that's why you can't afford
gas. Well, let's go back
to
Barack Obama. I think something he said great during the 2008 campaign, which he said, it's great to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, but you got to own some bootstraps first, you know?
I think you're getting at what will be the core issue, and so is Dan. I think that I heard Romney's speech the day before the election. He made it at the University of Chicago. It was a great speech. It was all about freedom, both at a personal level and an economic level. The Republican candidate has to have a message of growth and opportunity, personal freedom, and has to try to contrast it to the Democrats' message of dependency and big government. The Democrats, by contrast, have to make the kind of arguments that Mark was making.
So I'll say this. Let's go back to Gingrich when he said African-American people or impoverished people need to see what a paycheck looks like. Okay? And so what you have here is Dan's rhetoric of Romney's, quoting Romney's rhetoric, he says, I believe in the American people to succeed. But what you have, the Republican message is always that poverty is a moral failure. You're poor because you've made bad choices.
No.
You're poor because you're not working hard enough.
Didn't say that at all.
But
did not
that's
say
what
that.
The code is. There's that, a criminalization of poverty in the society.
You know, I appreciate you psychoanalyzing my rhetoric or the Republican Party's rhetoric, but that's not it at all. That, I mean, sometimes that's the case if you're engaged in a life of crime, for example, that is not productive to making a lot of money, at least not legally. But that's not the same.
Back
thing.
Back shortly from
saying.
Chicago. Bruce Dumont back live in Chicago. Let's head south. Savannah, Georgia is the place. Sean is listening to us on POTUS on Sirius XM Radio. Nice to hear from POTUS tonight. Go ahead.
Hey, I'm an independent, and I just I want to talk about why the Etch-A-Sketch fits Romney.
Mm-hmm.
Please.
Well, go ahead. Okay, so I want someone on your panel to just kind of tell me, give me a position where Romney hasn't changed on. I mean, not only did he champion Romney care in his own state and supported and praised Senator Kennedy when he was the governor, but he was pleased with the appointment of Tim Geithner, the secretary of the Treasury. He supported the TARP bailout and supposedly financed his strength. So if the Tea Party was created in response to Obamacare and TARP, then doesn't that make everyone who votes for them, for Romney a hypocrite?
You have said exactly what I was trying to get at in a previous discussion of this. The Etch-A-Sketch line resonates precisely because it becomes this campaign's version of the flip-flop, and because it actually fits with what people see as the one of the two or three deep vulnerabilities Romney has. Romney care is another vulnerability, and his inability to connect personally with voters is the third vulnerability.
So President Obama said the Bush tax cuts caused the recession, then he extended them, said we would close Gitmo, then we're not going to. I mean, on and on and on, if you want to talk about inconsistent.
Excuse me.
Yeah. Okay.
Romney was not opposed when he made those soundbites.
I'm not talking
he
about.
He was not opposed.
Let me try and follow this logic. If the issue is hypocrisy, then since Obama has changed his position, forget Mitt Romney. Since Obama has changed his position on so many issues versus what he said in the 2008 campaign and what he's done as president, then you would say that anybody who would vote for Barack Obama for reelection was also a hypocrite.
Who's your candidate? Is Obama your candidate?
I'll tell you what, I'm an independent, and I'm going to vote for Obama because there's no one legitimate. Maybe if Jeb Bush ran or if somebody else ran, right, I could have voted for one of those guys. Maybe right. Even Christie. But
well,
you know what? Right now, with the folks who are still left in the race with Santorum, I mean, you got to say that Democrats are for big government, but Santorum, really? He's for the nanny state, controlling who can get married, women's choices, whether or not I can buy alcohol on Sundays. Next thing you know, I won't even be able to.
I agree with you.
No, I agree with you.
I was saying that earlier. I think that there's a kind of bossy side to the Democrats, and there's a bossy side to the Republicans.
That's a lot of demagoguery is what that is, and I'm glad Georgia won't be in play. So that'll be Romney state.
But getting back to Dan's point about Obama, I don't think ran to say he was principled. He always ran as a pragmatist to me. I think he ran as a pragmatist. He said, I've got aspirations. I have an agenda. I have some goals I want to achieve. But he's a pragmatist.
He ran on hope.
Man, you should replace David Plouffe because that's the best.
He ran on hope and change, which
Mark,
means nothing.
Why is it? The Obama campaign has set a goal of amassing $1 billion war chest for the 2012 race.
Sure.
That's an average of about $50 million a month beginning in early 2011. Through past January, they've raised an average of $24 million a month for themselves and the DNC. Why is he running so badly? Because at this point in the last election cycle, more than 23,000 supporters had given Obama a contribution of $2,000 or more, while in the current campaign cycle, only 11,000 have done so. And according to one Obama fundraiser, there's a lot of disaffection and buyer's remorse of the people I know. What's the problem?
I would say it's a couple things. The first thing would be that currently, if you're an Obama supporter, you are pummeled with fundraising emails. I'm constantly deleting. Every day I'm getting a donate $5, win a dinner with Barack Obama. And I like him. I support him, but I don't need to go to dinner with him. I don't need to hear about it every day. What you had back in 2008 during that campaign cycle is people were willingly seeking out to donate money to Barack Obama because they were so disgusted with George Bush. And you just don't have that kind of motivation right now.
Excellent point. You could run on aspiration last time. There are two kinds of disappointment, Bruce. One are the people on the left who actually don't think he's fulfilled the promises they read into the Hope and Change. Mm-hmm. And then the other are centrist pragmatists who are not happy with the high unemployment, the excessive regulation, the stopping Keystone and all of that. So he's caught betwixt and between.
And now he's got a record to run on, and he's got a very tough sell because what they're essentially trying to say is, don't believe your lying eyes. Believe what we say. So pay no attention to what I've done for the last 3 years or where we currently find this country. I inherited a mess, and it's going to get better.
Are you worried because I mentioned that you're part of the Occupy Wall Street, LaSalle Street effort, and you're going to be out there on the streets when they come to Chicago in May? Are you worried that if violence breaks out, and there has been some record of that historically, are you worried that that violence could lead to a similar reaction to the 1968 convention, and it would hurt the incumbent Democratic Party, and it would especially since many of them are going to be screaming and chanting against things that may be perceived to be in Mitt Romney's wheelhouse?
Sure. I don't think so for this reason. Obama has distanced himself. He really hasn't embraced the Occupy movement. And the movement itself has declared its nonpartisanship. It's out there trying to keep pressure up on just so many issues. It's a broad coalition of people, and I don't think it's going to
work. Well, it wasn't like Hubert Humphrey embraced the anti-war demonstrators either. Right. The question is
perception.
Whether or not all this perception spills over and affects them.
And certainly the Obama administration thinks so. That's why they yanked the G8. I don't think there's any question about
right.
why.
Sure. It's going to be the two big conventions in the summer, too. If we have high unemployment, and this could be a very long, hot summer. That's been one of the things that's so distressing about all of the Trayvon Martin issues.
And again, there's all
about.
And also, again, Romney is the poster boy for what the
1%.
The
1%.
On that note, we're out of time. Thanks very much, gentlemen, for being with us tonight. This program, a Genevieve production, produced in association with WLS Talk Radio in Chicago. Our thanks to Tom Veracruz, Dan Dorfman, and Khalil Khalil for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week at this time, same time, this is Bruce Tuchman. Good night from Chicago.